You are listening to Midlife with Courage. This is where women in midlife come for inspiration, motivation, and sometimes a little education to help them flourish after 40. Don't forget to hit that follow or subscribe button. Now let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Midlife with Courage. I am Kim Benoit, your host, and I'm so happy to have you all here. I'm also very happy to have my guest with me today. Her name is Meredith Thompson. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Kim. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you today. Why don't you just first tell us a little bit about yourself? Where in the world are you and what do you do?
Sure. My anchor job, the primary job, is I'm a research professor at a university in Utah. So I do a lot of research looking at our work lives and how our work and non-work lives affect one another. I am also the founder of Partner Lab. It's like my passion project that has developed over the last few years out of the recognition after my divorce that even though I had access to relationship science related to our closest, arguably most important relationship, I never consulted it and a lot of people don't have access to it. So building Partner Lab, so especially the taxpayers that pay for that research can have access to it and hopefully apply it to their lives. And so I get to bring some of my lived experience. And so I just feel like this passion project is the fruition of a lot of my personal and professional lives.
Let's dive into that personal part of it.
Sure.
Tell us your story. Maybe include a time when you really felt like you showed courage or felt courageous. Tell us about that.
Sure. Oh, let's see. There's a number of them actually kind of that come to mind, and I don't know that I would have necessarily seen them as courageous at the time. I think personally, it was the hardest decision I ever made, but it was probably, I consider it one of the top three best decisions I've ever made. And that was bringing my first marriage of 22 years to a close. I stayed 10 or 12 years too long. And, you know, for me, in many ways, it's probably easier or less overwhelming than it is for especially a lot of women, because I was the primary breadwinner. So I didn't worry so much about like what finances would look like. And it still took me like three tries to like really bring it to a close. And then after that, it was, you know, I think the next courageous thing was, it's very much related and related to what I do now, is dipping a toe in the dating waters at 43 after not having dated since high school. And I had no idea what I was doing. And some of the first dates were, it was clear. I had no idea what I was doing. So at the ripe old age of 43, I actually took a dating class, which really helped me get a better strategy and be more intentional. And so, yeah, those two things have really shaped the last 10 years of my life and given me also the courage. I feel like courage, there's a momentum to it, right? Mm-hmm. Once we do one thing courageous, and the saying that is often in my brain is, inaction breeds anxiety and action breeds confidence. And I think courage, you know, kind of comes with that. And so getting my personal life to a happier, healthier spot has led me to write a book and start two businesses, and which are things prior to my divorce that never in a million years would I have thought about doing. So one piece of courage led to another, which led to another. So I feel very fortunate.
I love that. Yes. Whether it's action is the first step, and whether it's courage or confidence, whichever way they come or whoever comes first, then just do it. Just do that action.
Take the step. Even if it scares the crap out of you, take the step.
Take the step. I just want to go back. As someone who, I've been married almost 38 years, so hopefully I won't have to worry about dating anytime soon. But you actually took a dating class.
I did. A friend of mine put me onto this class that's backed by research that the state of Utah offers. And it was like half a day. And the thing in particular I took away from it is the research finds that you really don't know if you can trust someone until you've known them for 90 days. And thus, we should not, as dating individuals, see someone more than once a week. And I think we can extrapolate from that. You know, that also means you shouldn't be on video calls like every night with this person or texting incessantly. And so I got more mindful about that as I went along. And I will say some of it is luck with my current partner. And when we started dating, it was right about the time I took that class, but I was not anywhere near introducing my youngest son, who's still living at home, to anybody. And so my now partner was in the town that I lived in only a couple of days a week for work. Mm-hmm. And those happened to coincide generally with when my son was with me. And so my son at that point was involved in a community theater. And so when he was at community theater in the evening, that was when me and my partner could have a date. And so literally for like the first 2 months, we saw each other every week for like an hour and a half, and that was it.
Wow.
I think women are maybe even more apt to get invested emotionally too quickly. And so it slowed things down. Actually, I've had a note in my list of videos and stuff to make content wise, like screw speed dating. What we want is slow dating. If you're really looking for a partner, like slow it down.
Enjoy it, savor it.
Yes, yes. And we certainly did. Like, I think our honeymoon period, whatever, however you want to define that, lasted longer because, you know, I only saw him once a week and it was like, oh, get to see him. I mean, just like giddy. And he was worth the giddy.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. And he was okay with that? Or did you tell him, well, we're going to do it this way? Or was it just how it kind of worked?
It kind of worked out that way. I mean, we were pretty direct with each other about what we expected. This is one of the main reasons I love him and appreciate him so much is I know I can take anything to him and say, hey, look, this is an issue, or I've got this problem, or, you know, even a complaint. Would you please put your dishes in the dishwasher and not on the couch? You know, whatever it is, silly stuff that kind of matters. And I know he is going to be even keeled about it. Like, he's not going to get his feelings hurt generally. He's not going to be defensive. He's a safe person. And that was something that I got the sense of, I think, pretty early on. And he was also the same. Actually, it's an interesting story that we didn't really recognize until a year and a half in, that we both approached dating very research-wise, like as a research project.
I was going to ask about that.
Oh, I am such a fan. But like 18 months in, we were having some conversation. We met on Match.com, because how else do 40-somethings meet people other than the apps? And before I started dating, my girlfriends were like, you can't put on there that you're a professor and you have a PhD. Like, you're going to intimidate guys. And so at first I didn't. I downplayed that. And then I would go on a few first dates, and there were a handful where the guy would say, well, you know, your job kind of intimidates me. And I learned very quickly, like, okay, that's a non-starter. And I'll be frank, it annoyed me at first. I was like, well, come on, like, don't be a twit. And then I thought, you know, that's very brave of them to actually share that, to be vulnerable and say that kind of intimidates me. And so when I would hear it, I was like, I get that. And it was really great meeting you. But with my partner, we were exchanging information. So after I had a few of those dates, I was like, no, I'm just going to, on my dating profile, I'm going to say, this is what I do. I was just very transparent, I guess, at least with that part of my life.
Sure.
And then we learned later that right about the same time I switched my profile, he realized he needed a woman with a PhD.
Oh, wow.
And that was right about like the same week that I changed mine to just be very transparent. And he said he knew at any point in time how many women with a PhD were on the dating market in Salt Lake City or Logan, Utah, because that's all he was looking for. He knew that's what he needed.
Wow.
And that's how we found each other. And so it's an anecdote of why I am very pro data. Let's use the data, and then let's use our intuition, our self-trust to make super smart decisions in whatever area of life we're talking about. Yeah.
There's no coincidences. I don't think that was meant to happen. I think
it was. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I love that. Yeah. Entering the dating world with a research mind.
Yes. I even had a list, which I think everybody should have one, because I know from experience and the research that I do as a professor that our romantic relationship has a bigger impact on our health, well-being, happiness, success than any other. Or it can shrink our lives, which is what my first marriage did. And so after I had a few of those hard pass early dates, I was like, okay, Meredith, you're trying to avoid somebody who gauges in this kind of behavior. I was avoiding things. I was like, what do I really want? And so I made a list, and I think I had like 19 or 20 things on it. And it wasn't like, you know, the garbage that we hear, like, oh, he's gonna be this tall, he's gonna have this color eyes, blah, blah, blah. No, it was, I remember one specifically was, has his own sense of self and holds on to it, can be accountable for his part in a conflict. I teach conflict resolution, and I wanted somebody who was ready to say, yeah, I misstepped there, or I didn't communicate well, or, you know, whatever it is. Because here's what I've especially learned in the last few years. Accountability is so freaking sexy. Because accountability means you can be safe. I have never felt unsafe or devalued or anything like that by my partner.
Yeah.
And, you know, it takes a look from him or one little touch. And, you know, he's getting lucky because I know he's always safe. And so I think that's so important. And if more people, especially men who are looking for a female partner, knew if you're willing to be accountable, that sends such a signal of emotional and physical safety that they're not going to be complaining in the bedroom being about not getting enough attention because, yeah.
I would never have put accountability and bedroom together, but I love
Yes.
it.
No,
Totally.
I, yes. If something happens to my partner and I have to go back on the dating market again, that's going to be the tippy top of my list because
Yeah.
it makes the world a better place, and especially in close relationships.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, I feel like when you go into the dating world at 40, it's a lot different than 20, and you have that experience and that wisdom to know what you want. And in life, women aren't going to settle. If they're at a good point,
No.
they're not going to settle for anything. And that sounds like what
No.
you did or what you're
Yes.
doing.
Yes. Well, and I recognize a few years after my divorce that I've been just continually, progressively making myself smaller, thinking that if I ignored my needs or my wants, then my spouse at the time would be happier and things would be better. And yeah, once I got out of that and realized how much deeper I could breathe when he moved out, and it was like, oh, I'm not going back. If I find a partner, I was excited to date because I was mostly curious. Like I hadn't done it really ever. And so I was curious to see one who was out there. But yeah, I wanted somebody that was going to add something to my life, not keep it neutral and definitely not take something away. And so hence the list.
Yeah, I love it. I'm a task-oriented person, so I like lists. I like to check things
Oh,
off. I
that's
can
it.
totally get in on that. I love that.
It was super helpful. I would go look at the list like after a second or third date or whatever and go, okay, how are we doing?
Yeah.
And it helped me be accountable to myself. Psychology, we have a saying, we live up to what we write down. I'd written it down. And so if I accepted something that was less than or in opposition to my list, I was betraying myself. And I'd spent like 26 years doing that.
Yeah.
Not going to do it anymore. Or at least I'm going to try not to do it anymore. I'm still sometimes working on the people pleasing side of
Oh yeah.
Meredith. Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you think it takes us so long to get to these wonderful
Oh,
points in our
yes.
lives?
That's a good question. I feel like I'm 52, so dealing with all the hormonal BS. And I do think some of it's, and I think some of the research bears it out, that some of it's hormonal because with more estrogen, we're like nurturing and caretaking. And then once that drops, we're like, this is garbage. It's somebody take care of me or, you know, whatever. And I think too, like, I don't know about you, but I didn't know who I was or what I wanted in my 20s. And maybe even, I think it was like mid 30s before I really started to understand that. Cause I was so worried, I think, about what other people thought and how I was perceived and doing all the things that I, quote, should be doing, that I didn't really give much thought to. What is it that I want? And I've got two sons. One is 28 and the other will be 23 in about a week. And once kids are out of the house, if you choose to have children, like that frees up so much of your brain to think on other things and go, all right, well, they're out. Like I don't have that responsibility. And I really enjoyed having kids, but it's also, I think it opens your brain up to the possibilities when you don't have anybody like that to take care of as much
Sure,
anymore.
sure.
Yeah. What
Did
about you?
you have kids young?
I did. I had my first when I was 24. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
I was just a couple years before that. We got married young and we were pregnant on our first anniversary, so we were only like 22. So I feel like, yeah, I was busy taking care of kids, and then I decided to go to nursing school, and I was too busy to worry about me, you know,
Right. Yes.
and nobody
Yes.
told me I should be, you know, until
Right.
I think
Yes.
you're right. I think
Yeah.
it's the hormones and the kids, and yeah, it's,
And I
yeah.
think there's more conversation in society now about, yeah, giving women space and recognizing they can have wants outside of taking care of somebody else. And so, yeah, I just find that a treat to step into it, even though in the beginning it feels a little weird, uncomfortable. You're like, this is new. I don't know about this, but yeah.
I've been through this the last year. I've been working with confidence and other women, and I've started saying, someone will say, oh, you do a good job on your podcast. And I used to be like, oh, yeah, thanks. Well, now I'm like, thank you. Mm-hmm. I do, don't I? I mean,
that's right.
It's almost that attitude. Like, yeah, I do. You're right.
Yes.
And I know.
I rock. Have you seen me?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, it's an amazing feeling. And I think more women are getting those messages too with podcasts and other women and connecting and stuff. So, yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I agree. Confidence can be a game changer.
It is for sure. Oh, my goodness. We have talked about this a little bit, but what I wanted to ask you about, but how women stop postponing their lives while they're waiting? Like, what are they waiting for? Why are we postponing?
I tend to think we are postponing because we're waiting possibly on two things. One, for permission, and two, for 100% confidence or clarity. Some of it goes back to early in our lives. A lot of times we're caretakers of somebody else, you know, a spouse, kids. And then, you know, sometimes I don't know about you, but right now it's aging parents. But waiting suggests that, yeah, I think you think you need somebody else's permission. And generally we don't.
Yeah.
I think we're also thinking about the downstream consequences of making an important decision or making a pivot of some sort. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, maybe we're not caretaking of others, but we're still looking outward instead of looking inward. And I know I've recognized just in the past couple of years that I tend to overfunction, and I think I've done it my whole life since I was like a kid, and I grew up with a single mom who was not particularly mentally or emotionally stable. And so I learned to overfunction early. And now it's like, I have to like catch myself like, is that your job? No, that's not your job. Just like set that aside. So can take care of that. And so I think, yeah, a lot of it is the permission and trying to wait until other people agree, or you don't think the pivot you want to make is going to impact others. Like, heaven forbid what we do impact others. And or they may not give us the thumbs up to do it, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. One thing I learned a few years ago was it's not my job to fix everybody else.
Yes.
That includes my children. That includes my family members.
Yep.
Even my husband.
Yep.
And once you realize that, that's their thing. They can handle it. That's whatever they do with it. That's theirs. It's not my responsibility. That was very liberating for me.
Totally. Yeah. But I think a lot of times we think about waiting as being neutral, mm-hmm. but I would argue it's not, especially the older we get. Waiting for whatever it is has a cost. A lot of times it comes to the cost of our energy or self-trust or time. Are you familiar with the podcaster Tim Ferriss?
I don't think so.
Okay. He's an author. He wrote an author of the 4-Hour Work Week. He has a podcast where he's usually interviewing a lot of high profile people. But he did a TEDx talk about fear setting that I use a lot, and I use it with my clients, where we look at the fear of something. Usually it's of changing jobs or moving or something like that, something we're going to change. And one of the pieces of it is looking at, what do we lose if we don't take action? What might we miss out on? And that's that part of there's more to the fear setting, and people can watch this TED Talk to look at the first two parts. But that part always gets me, because it's like, life is short and it's limited. And a lot of times we either don't consider or we downplay what we'll be missing out on if we don't take action.
You know? Yeah.
So that sticks with me often.
That's a great thing to keep in the front of your mind. I was going to say the back of your mind, but keep it in the front of your mind.
Nope, bring it there. Absolutely. Yeah.
Something else came to me as you were talking, and now it's gone. No, wait. Now it's there.
It usually takes me longer to get back there.
I did a ChatGPT search about midlife women and what are they afraid of? And what came up was they're afraid of not leaving a legacy, or, you know, they're gonna leave this world, and then what? How are they gonna be remembered? That's kind of that triggered that thought in my head. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you're waiting to do something, why?
Mm-hmm. What's standing in the way?
What's standing in the way? If we've learned nothing since 2020, life is short, and like you said, let's take your action and stop waiting. Stop waiting around.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and recognize that wait in some form or fashion, waiting comes at a cost.
Yes.
And yeah, thinking about what is that cost. And I think the more specific we can get with ourselves about what that cost is, the more we may get that motivation and clarity about, okay, I'm going to take a baby step. Because, you know, generally, whatever we do, it may not go the way we want it to go or end the way we want it. Mm-hmm. But my framing is, as long as we learn something from it, it's not been a failure. And very rarely do we do something and the sky falls down.
Very rare.
If the sky's not going to fall down, go do the thing. Go do the thing. Just try it. Toe in the water.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to say, you know, you did something and then did you die? Nope. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yep. Okay. Thumbs up.
Awesome.
Yes. Yes.
Another thing I wanted to talk to you about is why fulfillment after 40 isn't really about reinventing ourselves. It's about reclaiming ourselves. And I love that concept. That's what I'm trying to tell people as well. You're not finding your voice. You're rediscovering it because it's still there.
Yes.
So let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. And one of the ways that I started thinking about it is, and this may come from my passion project that is such a synthesis of my experience, personal experience and work experience, that it's maybe what we should even be focusing on more is integration. And so integrating, I mean, we may look back in our 20s and go, oh my gosh, like, why did we make that decision? Why did we do X, Y, or Z? But that's still part of us. And it's made us who we are now. And so integrating more of perhaps the parts of us that we've put over in a corner while we were raising children or developing our career, and like inviting that person back into the conversation. You know, I think reinvention can sound exciting, and it is. But I think a lot of midlife dissatisfaction comes from us not being integrated, from living too far from who we actually are as individuals. So that's that. I see it as like the integration part. And I think that's a lot more satisfying for a lot of people.
Yeah. I love the picture that that creates in my head. There's this little part of me that I put away and put it over there. Now, okay, we're going to bring her back.
Yes.
I like to think of that as when we're small and young kids, we have all this energy and positive outlook, and then the world comes in and oh, go away. So bring that little girl back in some ways.
Absolutely. I think along with that, maybe this is just my experience, that I feel like there is opportunity and maybe even necessity at times to grieve who we were not earlier or who we felt like we weren't allowed to be. I came from a very high demand religion until I was in my early to mid 30s. And I feel like from various people, I got flack from having a career. Like, you're supposed to be home, you're supposed to be taking care of children.
Oh, really?
And so I felt like in some ways I couldn't really be fully who I was as a tech professional and then as a professor. And so, being able to grieve that person that you had to put over in the corner for a little while.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes we might want to focus on the reinvention or the integration, but sometimes we need to grieve who we had to give up there for a while before we could move on to integrating.
I love how you put that. You're giving me all these things to think about.
That's what these conversations should be about.
Yes.
I love it.
So let's talk about your passion project. Tell us more about that.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ladies, I am so excited about my new venture in this podcast. I'm calling it Midlife with Courage Unfiltered. You are going to get me, Kim Benoy, once or twice a month. I'm going to be getting real with you about the conversations that I have with my guests, and I'm going a little bit deeper. I'm going to bring my own personal experiences into it. I'm going to share what I've got going on in the hopes that you will share right back with me. This is not going to be me just talking in front of the microphone. I want your input. I want your participation. If you go to my show notes at the end of this episode, you'll see a support the show. That is where you can subscribe to Midlife with Courage Unfiltered. For only $5 a month, you're going to get this extra bonus content once, twice a month, and we're going to talk about what's really happening in midlife. I'm going to share my experiences. I'm going to get real. I'll probably get a little vulnerable. I'll be sharing things I don't normally share. So please subscribe so that you can get in on the founding members of this new Midlife with Courage Unfiltered. I'll see you there.
Sure. And I named it Partner Lab in part because I tell people that I made my current partner in a lab and could not have made him any better, even with all his quirks. And he puts up with my quirks. But it came from recognizing that most people don't have access to the research on relationships and what makes them happy and what undermines them, things like that. Or even if they have access to it, you read an academic journal article and you don't just read the abstract and you're like, I have no idea what that just said, because it's written for academics and not for non-academics. And so being able to take that and translate it to what actually helps people live healthier, happier lives, and especially their relationships, because I know our relationships have this ripple effect, and they can either be a really beneficial, healthy ripple effect, or they can be the opposite. Mm-hmm. I've experienced both. And so Partner Lab right now is on the front end, really focused on helping people get out of what I can call relationship limbo. So they're kind of one foot in, one foot out of the relationship. Mm-hmm. I made it with me of, 2006 to 2016 in mind, because I stayed in that first marriage way too long. And because I was just stuck in that indecision, I've built a lot of the tools with friends in mind who are or have struggled with that. And we can't have a healthy, fantastic relationship until we decide, are we fully in on the one we're in? And okay, let's together figure out what we're going to do to make it better. Mm-hmm. Or we determine, actually, yeah, this, I don't think this is fixable. Or I want to fix it, but my partner doesn't. If both people aren't in, that's a non-starter. Mm-hmm. And so developing research-backed tools that help people get that clarity based on decades of relationship science, and then equipping them with tools to figure out, okay, what are their next steps?
Okay. So what does it look like? How would someone use that?
The tool I'm most excited about that is going to launch hopefully in the next couple of days is a stay or go tool. And so it looks at 5-6 of the top relationship factors that shape relationship quality or health and happiness. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people would say, what's the most important thing for a happy relationship? And a lot of people would say, that's communication. It's a little bit of it, but there's so many other things that have a much bigger effect. And so really honing in on those things that research find leads to the highest quality relationships. And they're taking basically multiple choice kind of questions to understand the health of their relationship, because the research finds that it's not so much what our partner does or what we do, it's our experience in the relationship. So like personality doesn't matter that much. Your home of origin doesn't necessarily matter that much. It's how we experience the relationship. So measuring their experience of the relationship, and then they get the results that say, okay, here's where the relationship seems really healthy, here's where it doesn't. And then using a structure that says, our recommendation would be you need to seriously consider ending this relationship, especially if it's not safe, mm-hmm. or it's very low trust and has been for a long time. Or some that, people are just curious, how does my relationship, where am I along the healthy, unhealthy continuum? Yeah. And this is something that over half of our users and clients have asked for over the last, a year or so. Mm-hmm. And so we're excited to roll that out to see what that looks like. And then we have other things that are like deeper dives, more workshops. And soon we'll be starting a laser focused coaching around that relationship decision, helping people get clarity. Because some people, I think, want the human connection, right?
Sure.
I think it's really important to include the research, but I think people sometimes also want someone to connect with that helps them make sense of what their results are. So we're looking at that as well.
Yeah. If you're telling me that my relationship probably isn't in a good place and I need to end it, I want to know more about why.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Do you get people do this and say, you know what, that's what I thought? Is it an affirmation of what they already know? Or are they mostly finding new things?
I think for some people it is. I'm trying to think back on some of the comments we get from users of the various tools and assessments we've got. I think what we hear most often, especially for people who seem to be in low quality relationships, is it is so good to hear that I'm not crazy. It is like the validation, not just like affirmation, but validation of I'm not imagining this. Because I know I was like that in my first marriage. I thought, everybody from the outside seems to think this is great. Like when my ex and I split, they were like, what? That's because they weren't in the house. They weren't seeing actually what was going on. And we were good at acting when we were outside of the home. Yeah. And so I think I see a lot of it too. What we offer is regret insurance. So I think a lot of people stay in relationships that aren't working, but especially if you have kids, that is like the hardest, it's the hardest decision I ever had to make. Mm-hmm. And so you want to make sure you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's if you're going to bring the relationship to a close.
Yeah.
And I think because, you know, this isn't just some crazy lady in Utah's ideas. This is like grounded in research.
Yeah.
That they can say, okay, what I'm experiencing is this is reality. This is more objective. And so I feel like I'm getting data. And I think data is really important for helping us get that clarity that says, okay, what's happening is what I thought. I'm not crazy. And so now that I have this information, I can take a step to make the situation better depending on what that looks like for each person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Meredith, if there's people out there listening, who would be, I know there's people out there listening.
Yes, they are.
Who would be a good candidate to take this or to access this partner? Mm-hmm.
I would say, I think anybody who's in a couple. So some of our tools are just to give people, they're like, I know there's parts of my relationship that are good and the other things that just kind of feel off. But a lot of times it's really hard to put our finger on what's off. Mm. And so we've got one broader assessment that measures 24 different relationship factors called the Clarity 360. And so people may, they're like, I've got a good relationship. I want to make it better. This, that kind of tool can help them like know where to focus some of their energies and why do things feel off in a certain area that we don't like have a name for it.
Sure.
But a lot of our tools are for those people also who are relationships okay, it's not great. And on some days it's like really bad. And then, but then other days it's good. And like, that's where a lot of people get stuck is, you know, some days are really, really bad. And then other days you're like, oh, well, it was pretty good today. So you feel this push pull, you're back and forth, you're back and forth. And that is, it's exhausting. And it takes time off our life. That's what the research finds.
Yeah.
Having a distressful marriage
or
relationships. And then too, for the people that maybe know, I think our bodies know when we're not in a good relationship before our brains are willing to accept it. And so sometimes I think it's for those people too, who are like, I know this is bad. I'm not sure how bad. And, you know, am I making too big of a deal of this or that? Our goal is to have something for everyone, but in particular, we're really building out tools that help those who have been in an unhappy relationship for a long time figure out what to do next.
So how would people find this? Where can they go?
Sure. They can go to mypartnerlab.co. They can also connect with me on LinkedIn. We've also got various social media pages and accounts that I can share with you. But our website's probably the best place to stop and take a look and see what's there that might be a good fit for the kind of help that they're looking for.
Okay. I will put the link in the show notes, as they say, so people can find you.
Great.
Before we say goodbye, is there any last little message you want to leave with our listeners, Meredith?
Let's see. I think that what I would leave with is you have one short, beautiful wildlife. If you want to do something and you're hesitating, just dip that toe in the water. Consider it an experiment. Just because we're going to try something doesn't mean we have to do it forever and ever. And I think sometimes we think about things as black and white. So go dip that toe in the water, go have the experience, see what happens, and then take that next step. Baby steps.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Meredith. I just love this conversation.
Thank you. Me too. Me too. Awesome. It's great to be here and it's wonderful to connect with you, Kim.
Yeah, same here. Well, hopefully we will talk again soon.
That sounds great. Let's do it.
Thanks
so much.
Thank you for listening to Midlife with Courage. If you liked what you heard, I would love it if you would leave a review. Or even better, send a link of this episode to a friend. Until next time, take care of your beautiful self.